From historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, this is The Seminary Explores. Conversations about people, politics, theology, and life with your host, Dr. Nelson Strobert.
Good day. Welcome to The Seminary Explores. My name is Nelson Strobert, and today my guest is Professor Kristen Larchin, who is professor at the Lutheran Theological Seminary here at Gettysburg. And welcome to The Seminary Explores.
Thank you, Nelson. Yeah. Nice to be here.
Yeah, and I should also tell the listening audience that not only are you an interviewer, being interviewed today, but you are our new host to the Seminary Explorers.
So, very exciting.
So this is a great way for people to get to know you.
Super. Yeah.
So I introduced you as Professor of Systematic Theology. And I'd like you to share with our listening audience, what is systematic theology? Because when I tell that to people or mention that term, they look quizzically at me.
Right. Their eyes kind of glaze over. It's unfortunate that it's such an intimidating phrase, because in actuality, it's just describing the work that really every thinking Christian does when she tries to think about her faith, her belief in Jesus Christ, and relate that to the rest of her life in the world. And so Anselm had this really lovely phrase that's often used, faith seeking understanding. And so it's this idea that systematic theology in some ways asks the same questions over and over. Who is God for us today? What does it mean that Jesus saves us today? Who is the human person in this time and place? And so it's really wonderful, exciting work, because you're really sort of relating word to the world. And so everything's fair game. So people who are trying to look at issues of ecology, people who are engaging issues with science, all of that systematic theology. So yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, but how do you prepare to be a systematic theologian? It's like when you're covering so much.
Yeah. Well, certainly we all specialize. And so my particular specialty is work with interreligious dialogue. And the field that I do is particularly called comparative theology. And so for me, what I'm trying to do is, as a Christian, learn about other religious traditions, not only for the sake of my neighbor, the love of my neighbor, who is a person in a different religious tradition, but also for the sake of my own faith. Because I believe that God reveals God's self universally. And so as a Christian, I think I have something to learn about God and God's work in the world through my Hindu brothers and sisters and my Buddhist brothers and sisters. And so it's really exciting, interesting work.
Okay, but what brought you to this area?
Yeah. I was born and raised Lutheran. I was baptized and confirmed Lutheran. But by the time I went to college, I didn't go to a Lutheran college. But I did, I was always interested in religion. I mean, I think religion asks to me some of the most pressing, interesting questions. And a really early informative person in my thinking was Thomas Merton. I took a course on Thomas Merton and was really engaged in his own self-reflection as a Trappist monk, but then also the way he was engaged in conversation, particularly with Buddhist monks. He was interested in Buddhism. And so that became a really deep interest for him toward the end of his life, and he was firmly convinced that he could remain a good Catholic monk and also be learning from Zen Buddhist and Tibetan Buddhism. And so that kind of stuck with me, I think. And then by the time I went off to seminary, I went to Wartburg Seminary, my most profound and important mentors were all systematic theologians. Again, they were asking the kind of questions that I wanted to ask.
Okay. When you meet seminarians, you know, and you introduce them to this area of theology, what is their reaction? Since they come here very firm or committed to the Christian tradition, and then you're exposing them to something that's quite different when they're preparing to be Christian pastors or educators or diaconal ministers.
You know? Right. It really varies. I think for some people, they're very nervous when we start talking about interreligious dialogue, because they feel that in some way when you start giving credence to other religions, listening to other religions, that maybe in some way you're marginalizing scripture, minimalizing what God has done in Jesus. And so they feel that it's a challenge to the faith in some way, even to imply that there's something to be learned. And so we talk about what that means and how it's not actually making our faith less, it's making our faith more. But that's often a hurdle for people. But on the other hand, I have some students who come who have already been thinking about other religious traditions in college, maybe just their experiences in their hometown. They've had friends of other religious traditions. And so for them, it's really encouraging and exciting to think that they are preparing for public ministry in a tradition that's really open to that kind of religious work, because they know that when they get out into the parish, the parishioners are asking these kind of questions, and they want to know, well, what does our faith say about these other religious traditions? As a Christian, what am I supposed to think about Islam? Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of openness as well. So the reaction really can vary.
Yes. And it's certainly, in terms of fear, you mentioned fear by students, and certainly since 9/11, we've had, so many stereotypes of Islam,
right.
and certainly there's been, it seems to me, a more emphasis on trying to understand Islam,
yeah.
and other traditions as well, to break down these fears and suspicions,
right.
Because of terrorism, etc.
Right. And I think, people are aware, the media, broadly speaking, is both a great help and a hindrance, right? I mean, on the one hand, you can go on the web and you can learn all sorts of wonderful things and see pictures and watch videos about these different religious traditions, so you can be much more informed than we had been before. But as you also know, there's a lot of really terrible stuff out, and the news media is not always our friend.
Right.
And so I think that there's a way in which there's a sense that we need to correct some misconceptions that are out there, and also give people better resources where they can have more reasoned judgments and assessments of some of these other religious traditions.
Exactly. I know when students have gone abroad and gone to some of these areas, they come back and they say, I'm listening to the news differently now.
That's right.
That's right. There's another perspective that I'm hearing or I've heard, and that brings me to a new understanding.
Right, exactly. Right.
But one of the things that has intrigued me about your work, your academic work, is that you broadened it in terms of your last sabbatical.
Yeah.
Actually, your first sabbatical.
Yeah, only sabbatical.
But could you describe what your sabbatical entailed,
right,
for our listening audience?
Yeah, so this was just an experience of a lifetime, really. I received a very generous grant, a Lilly Foundation grant, through the Association of Theological Schools. And I designed it around four what I called holy cities in four major world religious traditions. So I went to Varanasi for Hinduism.
For our listening audience,
yes.
Where's Varanasi?
Varanasi is in India. It's on the banks of the Ganges. It was formerly called Benares.
Oh, okay.
And again, it's one of the most ancient cities in India. And then I went to Kyoto in Japan, and for Buddhism. And then I was in Istanbul for Islam. And then I went to Jerusalem, particularly, but then also more broadly Israel, Palestine. And so for me, the idea was, I have done this academic work in these other religious traditions, and have had certainly interreligious experience here in the United States. But I felt that it was important to go to these cities and these countries where Christianity is a very, very slim minority, and where the dominant culture then is influenced by these other religious traditions, and just sort of experience what that was like, talk to people, visit places, and have my work then infused by those experiences.
Oh, okay. And from those experiences, and you chose these particular cities, and was there one key piece in each that a new understanding that emerged from you, for you from each of these places?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I could lift up one specific experience from each of these places that has kind of stayed with me. And so in Varanasi, I had mentioned that it's on the Ganges, and part of there's a tradition in Hinduism that believes that if you die on the banks of the Ganges, you are immediately liberated, you achieve moksha. And so many people come to Varanasi to die, or after they die, they have their funerals there. And of course, cremation is the norm in mm-hmm. India. And so there's a particular place on the Ganges where these cremations are, multiple cremations are going on 24 hours a day. And
really?
So to be able to watch the rituals and the rites that are associated with the kind of letting go of the body and the kind of shepherding the soul from one life to the next was really fascinating. And there's so much about Hinduism that is seen in this ritual. And so that was just, that was really an amazing experience. And then in Kyoto, I was able to participate in a Zen tea ceremony with a Zen monk, which was also just, again, to experience kind of the Buddhist aesthetic that is so associated with Buddhist principles of harmony and simplicity. Mindfulness, that was also just to be able to live that rather than just read about it.
Right.
That was really, really amazing. And then when I was in Istanbul, you know, for me, there wasn't so much one experience there, but rather we have a sense, unfortunately, in the United States of Islam as being so militant.
Yes.
Very oppressive. Kind of anti-democracy, mm-hmm. and then you go to Turkey, which is this democratic, tolerant, open society, and certainly Istanbul, which feels like any other Western city I've ever been in, and yet it's devoutly Muslim. And so just the experience of being in this place and seeing all of these people who are, again, very devout Muslims, many of the women veil, and the mosques are full. And yet it's open and tolerant as any city in the United States. And that, just to experience that, was really valuable. To be able to come home and tell my students, oh, you must know that this picture of Islam that you're getting in the news is actually not representative of all of mainstream Muslim.
Yeah, that's helpful to our listening audience.
Right.
Very
right.
much so.
Yeah.
But what, in term, you know, you went to these places and... as an American and a woman, and was there any resistance, or were they curious about your wanting to understand their culture or their religious practices?
Yeah, people were really open, and I think, you know, again, particularly, of course, in Istanbul, very enthusiastic that someone who teaches Christian theology would be open and want to experience more about Islam. I mean, they know how they're perceived, and so they, for Muslims, it's exciting to think there can be this kind of dialogue. And I think that, so everywhere I went, people were warm and engaging and interesting and helpful, and that was really, it was really exciting.
You did not see, you did not feel or sense an anti-American feeling?
No, I didn't, not anywhere that I went. I think for me, the hardest place, and this wasn't about anti-American at all, but of course, India, there is such deep, pervasive poverty in India. And so that was just, I was there by myself, and it was hard for me to see that day after day, because you just, we take so much for granted here in terms of what we have, and to be in this context where so many people live in just absolutely abject poverty. That was almost crushing. I mean, it was really hard to experience. So that was... and so I think for me, then I have to ask as a Christian, you know, what does that mean? And how do I see God here? And how am I experiencing? So I think it was just to be in these new settings, asking the questions that I ask here, again, seeing God in a new way and thinking about God's work in a new way. That was just really very exciting and really rewarding.
Okay, very good. This is fascinating to me. But and out of this your experience and sabbatical, you produced a new book, another book, I should say.
Yeah.
And promise the audience, what is the title and what is the emphasis of the book?
Yep. So the book is titled Finding God Among Our Neighbors, and it's meant to be an interreligious, well, a little mini interreligious systematic theology. And so normally if you read a systematic theology mm-hmm. that's written in the 21st century, so for our listening audience, what that means is you have a chapter on God, you have a chapter on creation, a chapter on humanity. What does the church say about these things, right? That's what a systematic theology is trying to do. And then often there's a single chapter that treats interreligious dialogue, but it's separate from all of the kind of Christian theological reflection.
Right.
And so it's all the metaphor that I've used is, typically for Christian systematic theology, you build the house, you lay the foundation, you put up the structure, and then when that's all done and settled, interreligious dialogue can be like window dressing, right? It just sort of ornaments the house,
right.
But the foundation wouldn't change if you
exactly.
took out interreligious dialogue. And so for me, I want to reverse that pattern and say, I want the dialogue to be part of the foundation. So as a Christian, as I am just beginning to wrestle with what Christians say about God, I want to include in my dialogue, as a dialogue partner, these other religious traditions and their reflections on God, so that it becomes a much more organic, integrated process, the interreligious dialogue, rather than something that's sort of tacked on at the end, you know, that almost like an optional.
Well, you're breaking new ground here, it seems to me,
in terms of theological.
Certainly a different way of doing systematics than what I had.
Right.
Several decades ago. But the world has changed too. And
it
I think
has.
That work
right.
is reflective. Your
That's
work
right.
is reflective of this changing view of the world.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Oh, yeah. And now I also know that you returned to Turkey. Is that correct? I didn't know about that, but could you share that experience?
That was, again, a really powerful experience just this last September. So the connections that I had made in Turkey, many of the people were associated with the Nursi Foundation. So Beni Azamin Sayed Nursi is a Muslim thinker, Islamic thinker,
okay.
Turkish thinker, who was born in the mid 19th century and then died in the 20th century. And so he was living in the destruction of the Ottoman Empire and when Ataturk came to power and Turkey became a secular republic. But he believed very strongly that Islam could and should be open to engagement with the secular world and was not opposed to democracy, not opposed to science. And so his main work was an extended commentary on the Quran in which he's trying to show that there's nothing antithetical in the Quran to kind of life in the modern world, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have a conference every 3 years, and so I was invited back to give a presentation at this conference. And it was really exciting because, of course, I was one of the few Christians who was there speaking. It was a majority a Muslim audience. And again, I was just sort of overwhelmed with the welcome and hospitality that I received and the way people were eager to talk about, well, how do I as a Christian see Nursi and how do I read the Quran and what do I think about Muhammad? And so we were asking these really exciting, interesting questions, and it was quite a transformative experience for me. It was just great.
Oh, well, I'm delighted that you were able to do that.
Me too.
And certainly a great representative for Gettysburg Seminary.
Yeah, exactly. Happy to do that.
And the work of systematicians in the global context.
Right. Yep.
And I think that's one of the things that I see that you're bringing to the task,
yeah.
this global vision of this area of theology.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would like to ask it, you know, as a peek to the future, what are you now working on?
Well, I hope to continue, obviously, this kind of interreligious work. And the project that I'm hoping to begin next will look specifically at salvation. This is kind of my favorite theological loci, my favorite theological topic. And so, and again, this is often for Christians where the most tension is around interreligious dialogue. Are others saved?
Right.
If they're saved, well, then are they saved in Jesus? And what about my salvation? And so I'd like to look at the way, specifically the way that other religious traditions treat salvation, what that word even means. Do you use that word? And then again, how we can be challenged and informed in those conversations.
Okay. Well, thank you. I can't believe our time is up.
Yeah, thank you so much. Wonderful to talk with you, Nelson.
Indeed. And I've been talking with Professor Christian Larsen, who is the new co-host of the Seminary Explorers, along with Jerry Christensen and myself. And we've been talking about interreligious dialogue and interreligious comparative theology and her work here at Gettysburg Seminary. For the Seminary Explorers, this is Nelson Strober. Have a good day.
You've been listening to The Seminary Explores from historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a production of the Lutheran Theological Seminary at Gettysburg. We invite you to visit our website at www.ltsg.edu. All opinions expressed on this program are those of the individual speakers and are not necessarily those of Gettysburg Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.